Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, whenever you're listening to this. It's a beautiful day right here in Iowa, and we're very thankful for that.
Yes, we are.
We have a very interesting book to talk about today. I tell you, every page has something on it that you just, got to relate to.
And the book is titled Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. And our guest is Mark Lesser, who is a CEO, a Zen teacher, an author, and leads trainings and talks worldwide. He has led mindfulness and emotional intelligence programs at many of the world's leading businesses and organizations, including Google, Genentech, and Kaiser, and he is currently CEO of ZBA Associates, a company providing mindfulness-based leadership trainings and creating community by supporting ongoing groups. And he's also the author of Less, Accomplishing More by Doing Less, and Know Yourself, Forget Yourself. And Mark's website is marklesser.net. That's MarkLesser.net. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Mark.
Thanks. It's good to be here. Hello, Monica and Caroline.
And hello there.
Where are you calling us from today?
I am in rainy Mill Valley, California, just north of San Francisco.
Oh, I thought it never rained in California. Or was that just a song from the 70s?
It's a song. That's a song.
That was a song, yeah. Well, Monica, you know that better than that. You were born in California.
That is true. And, of course, with the landslides and so forth there, that's caused by rains.
Yeah.
California has really been hit hard by natural disasters in the last few years, hasn't it?
It's been really intense with the fires have been just devastating. I have several friends who lost their houses from fires have really been the big thing. And now we've had a super rainy winter. There's concerns about landslides and floods. Mm. And people used to worry about earthquakes. That hardly makes the headlines at
right.
all anymore.
Right.
And of course, Iowa, which is where we are, has been hit by floods this year. But on the west side, the last major flood was closer to here. But we live in a town, I live in a town where there are no rivers, so it really doesn't flood. Because it's kind of hard to flood if you're not near a river.
Uh-huh.
Or an ocean.
Or the ocean.
Yeah. Right. Or a lake or some body of water bigger than a pond. Anyway, let's talk about seven practices of a mindful leader. Tell us how you became, how this became your kind of calling to teach this.
Yeah, I think it all started when I was in college in a while ago, actually, the 1970s. I was a student at Rutgers when I took a 1 year leave of absence to kind of to explore something. I really sensed that my life was pretty narrow by having grown up in New Jersey and gone right into Rutgers and I traveled out, took a 1 year leave of absence and came to San Francisco. And I walked into the San Francisco Zen Center one day and ended up living there for 10 years. As you might imagine, my parents not thrilled about this at the time. But it totally opened up my world and changed my life. And it's funny if you kind of course, no one ever thought that would ever have anything to do with, how I would make a living or what I would do with my life. But it, if you kind of fast forward, I these days I find myself teaching mindfulness and meditation in places like Google. Interesting. I noticed on the front page of today's New York Times is a big article about mindfulness being taught to the United States military, which is so there's this huge interest in these kind of mind training practices like mindfulness. Anyhow, that's how it started for me. And then at the same time, while I was living at the Zen Center, I found that I kept being asked to take on different leadership roles, which surprised me, including running a kitchen in a Zen monastery called Tassajara, which happens to turn into a resort and conference center in the summertime. And then my 10th year of living at the Zen Center, I was the director. And I had this kind of strange insight that though my core practice, you know, was the practice of meditation and mindfulness, and I was studying and practicing Zen, I was also a leader, and I was also running a business. And I wondered, why isn't everybody doing this? These two activities seem like they go so well together, this kind of radical sense of developing self-awareness and helping others and you know, getting to know yourself and going beyond yourself. Just seemed like, well, this is really good for the world of leadership and work. And I decided that was what I was going to do with my life, and went right from there to business school.
And I went, which I must have back, made your went, parents happy.
Yes, of course. And maybe they were a little concerned about, like, what was wrong? You know, maybe there was something, it just seemed so odd. A lot of people thought it was very odd. It all made great sense to me. I went to business school, got an MBA degree, and then I ended up starting a few different companies and being in the kind of, I really had that entrepreneurial bug. But at the same time, I always felt like my real aspiration was this kind of integration of these contemplative practices with the world of business and getting stuff done. And that's really what this book, Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, is. In a way, it's a little bit of my own path and what I've learned, but mostly it's kind of setting forth what I think are kind of seven really core ways to integrate mindfulness practice with leadership and work. And then what I love about these, you know, even though these are framed as leadership and work, they really go beyond that. They impact my writing life. They impact all of my relationship life.
Well, actually, mindfulness and caring about other people, which I think is important in this book, is common sense. And we seem to have lost that in our, you know, am I right?
Yeah, well, you know, what one person's common sense is another person's radical philosophy, right?
Well, when you're caring about other people and not just yourself, then you come to the conclusion that, yeah, there are lots of different ways of looking at things. But, you know, caring about other people is primary.
Well, even, you know, even to unpack that a little bit, right, the reality of how much we are interconnected, right, that we are, you know, and these days, right, it's not only locally, not only in our communities, but globally we are. I mean, it's one of the, I'm amazed, like, these days when I do some programs in places like Google, for instance, or any high tech company, people are working with each other literally across the globe. You know, even in my, you know, like I now have a small, you know, at the moment I'm running a small kind of consulting company, and I work with a web developer who her team is in India, and so it's a kind of amazing this how vast and powerful we are interconnected with each other these days.
Well, two of your seven practices are really focused on others. And in my kind of limited experience, it seems like a lot of times people think or even in practice that meditation, which is similar to mindfulness or other spiritual practices, tend to be in that vein, tend to be very much focused on the self. You know, what do you think that's common, and how do you overcome that?
Well, you know, more and more, you know, so many ways I could respond to that, but one very practical way is I come into contact with so many people that get how useful it would be for them to have a regular meditation practice and really struggle with it. And what I find is that people are attempting to do it by themselves. And I more and more find myself teaching that mindfulness was never meant to be an individual sport. It is a group sport. It's like thinking you're going to play soccer only by yourself. That there is, I mean, in a way, there is a really different sense and quality and feeling to actually doing meditation practice with other people. Now, I know that if that's just not possible, of course, it's better to do it by yourself than not at all. But the other piece to that is that, you know, in almost all contemplative traditions, whether it's Buddhist or Christian or Muslim or any, at the core of them is this sense of helping others, this sense of compassion. And it's so built in to all of these traditions that it's almost easy to miss, because it's just so assumed. It's so assumed that the reason that we do these practices is so that we can better show up, you know, for the people that we live with and love. And these days, I think one of the reasons that mindfulness and meditation are being so embraced in the work world is that the level of collaboration and the need for people working in teams has exploded. And people get that in order to work effectively with others, we need to have this sense of inner knowing, this self-knowing, this understanding of our own emotions and feelings and proclivities, and also this tendency to be able to actually operate in a world where we can feel comfortable enough in our own skins that we can actually help others and be there for others and not be so kind of playing these political games and protecting ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, you know, people need to have a feeling of inner peace?
Yeah, or at least, you know, if not, you know, inner peace, that's a hard one. You know, we're complicated creatures. I mean, I can't say, you know, if someone were to ask me, do I have a feeling of inner peace? Well, at times. But I think more maybe, I would say inner confidence. Inner confidence would include that even when I'm not feeling inner peace, that's okay. And that I can appreciate and be present for whatever I'm feeling. And I can also be curious about what another person is feeling. If I'm feeling, you know, out of alignment, or if there is something that that I'm not understanding, that I have enough inner confidence to be curious and want to understand another person.
You know, I'm going to speak to two things you said. First, the idea of meditating in a group being more, in a way, more powerful and an easier practice to stick with. I live in Fairfield, Iowa. You probably know that's the home of the Transcendental Meditation Movement.
Yes.
In the United States. And I do practice, and I go to the group meditation when I'm here. Mm-hmm. Not all the time, but, you know, when I can. And it is easier to really get settled when you're in a group of people, you know, hundreds of people who are also there for that purpose. And when I'm gone, which I am a lot, I often lose my practice. You know, I'll skip this one, I'll skip this time, and somehow it's just easier to do here in the group.
Uh-huh.
So mm-hmm. yeah, so that's definitely the case.
I tell this the story in the book of when I first wandered into the, you know, I was 22 years old and I wandered into the Zen center and the first morning of meditation, I walked in and I took a seat and I noticed that next to me was this older woman wearing this brown shawl, and we never spoke, and I went home, and the next morning again I drove across San Francisco and wandered into the Zen center, and I went and sat in the same seat, and next to me this older woman wearing this brown shawl. Again, we never talked. The next morning, as I'm getting up, I'm feeling a little tired and thought, you know, maybe I'll sleep in this morning. But then I thought, oh, that woman will probably miss me. She'll probably worry about where am I? So I got to get up. So I got, you know, and then 10 years went by. So you know, and if you, I think about the, you know, these days, once a year at least, I do, you know, longer, like, you know, 7-day retreats. I can never do that by myself, right? You can only do that kind of practice with a group of people. And it's that similar sense that you're there for each other, and that there's something, I think we totally underestimate and don't understand the level at which we humans are connected to each other, and how potent and powerful that is in all parts of our lives. We just don't get it.
I think you're right.
Oh yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
You accentuate in your book over and over the importance of proper breathing techniques, and I'm in a choir, and our choir director has us doing exercises with our breathing before we start practicing, and I have always believed in belly breathing, and as a singer I have used that technique. But I think it's also important, like when I go to the dentist, to calm myself. That's what I do. I belly breathe, and so it's you know, it's very important. Breathing is extremely important. We take it for granted because we have to do it every second. But there are techniques that will help us to calm ourselves and so forth. And I'm hoping that people I'm really encouraging people to read this book, because it's full of all kinds of things that the ordinary person in any walk of life, you don't have to be a CEO or a business person. You just can get things for your everyday life out of this book. And I'm very glad that I was able to read it.
Yeah, I would even just kind of to respond to that a little bit. I would say that the kind of underlying assumption and philosophy of this book is that the question is, how can you resume your kind of full functioning? Noticing, so like using the example of breathing, often we restrict our breathing without even noticing it, right? That we, little by little, we lose that, you know, that full kind of open, full, you know, whether it's belly breathing or full body breathing that we're born with, and that it's part of our birthright, and little by little we can lose it. And this is true, I think, of a lot of how we function, that we lose that full access to our our intuition and the wisdom of our emotions, and so much of these practices, in a way, are based on the assumption that our aspiration is to not so much to take on new techniques, but to be able to take on our full functioning. So we need some of these techniques or exercises in order to help us do that better.
Well, how many times on TV, when there's an occasion where somebody is under stress, and someone will say to them, "Oh, take a breath."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's just a natural response that you think, well, people just need to stop, take a breath, and calm themselves, and that's the whole thing.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting how, there's some studies of that great athletes, tennis players, apparently, in between points, there's about 20 seconds, and they have trained themselves to completely rest and relax the body through paying attention to the breath, readying for that kind of next point, that next surge in energy. Mm. And this seems like, I find myself teaching and applying similar skills to that in people in the work world who, in terms of managing one's energy, I tend to do that in my own writing practice. So I tend to write in, short spurts. Like I find, maybe 30 to 45 minutes of focusing and then relaxing, just kind of letting it all go for, maybe 5, 10, 15 minutes, and then coming back to focusing on writing or working.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mark Lesser, author of 7 Practices of a Mindful Leader.
Well, I was just going to say, so he's taking a breather.
I'm just creating some space to see, I'm curious about both of you. What? Yes, and here we are. Here we are, breathing together. In some of the teaching I do, I sometimes say, we are now a conspiracy, right? Because the word conspire means to breathe together, to breathe. And it's interesting how much of the words, inspire, inspiration is like this. This breath of newness and waking up. So there's so much in our language has these is about the breath.
Well, I wonder how conspiracy took on the negative connotation that it has.
Yeah,
good question.
That would be an interesting research into the etymology, if I'm using the word correctly, which is always fascinates me how words got the meaning and where they came from.
Yeah, well, I've been working on changing that because I think that we need this conspiracy of people looking to, help add more compassion to the world and to be able to, to use our voices and our businesses for the greater good and to do healing, and our planet needs a conspiracy of people who are concerned about it's funny, I was kind of talking about the essence and direction of these practices are kind of returning to the full functioning of human beings, and I would say the same is needed and true in our planet, right? The planet is incredible, right? I mean, again, the wisdom of it and how everything functions, and yet we're managing to kind of muck it up and not understand and live within the wisdom and forces that it's functioning as well. I mean, it's interesting that parallel.
Yeah. Mark, how did you sort of consolidate your thoughts into these seven practices? And are there really just seven, or is seven, seven habits of the effective leader, and seven, seven seems to be the number. So how'd you squeeze them into seven?
Well, there's a particular kind of funny, quirky story about this, right? Right. It was never all that intentional. These practices emerged one day, about 10 years ago. I was teaching mindfulness at Google, a mindfulness program that I helped develop, and it was becoming more and more popular, and there were longer and longer waiting lists of Google engineers and other employees wanting to take this mindfulness program. And I decided that it was time to train a group of Google employees to teach this mindfulness program as a way of growing it inside of Google. And people applied, and we had about a dozen people who we were in a train the trainer program. And I invited a good friend of mine, a Zen teacher and poet, a man named Norman Fisher, to come and be part of this training session. And as this meeting was beginning, I noticed that someone else had created the agenda for what we were going to do during this day. And the next activity, right after we started, it said that my friend Norman was going to give a talk about how to bring mindfulness into your, what are the core values that you need to focus on to be a mindfulness teacher? And I stealthily showed Norman, I pointed to the agenda that this is what he was going to do next, because I realized no one had told him that. And he very calmly got out a piece of paper and a pencil and just jotted down some notes and proceeded to give a talk to this group of Google engineers on the seven practices of what you need to focus on, the values that you need to embody in order to be a mindfulness teacher in Norman's view. And when I heard these practices, I just, like, my whole body kind of jolted, and I thought, these are wonderful practices. And I thought they were in a way very simple, but also quite unusual and powerful. And I ended up, I actually made a list of these practices and put them on everyone's desk, all the employees in my organization that I was running. We had about 20 people at the time. And I started kind of writing about them and giving talks about them. I get invited to speak at different leadership and mindfulness conferences. And then little by little, a book started to emerge. And then I started to feel funny, and I felt like, oh, I need to check with my friend Norman. And I called Norman and said, I was in the process of developing a book about these seven practices that he had taught. This was now a few years had gone by. And Norman says, of course, what seven practices? He had no idea what I was even talking about. And I read the list of the seven practices to Norman, and he said, oh, those are really good. And good luck with your book, and please send me a copy. And that was how those seven practices
emerged.
Well,
this might be a good time to let our audience know what the seven practices are.
Yes, great time. The seven practices are: love the work, do the work, don't be an expert, connect to your pain, connect to the pain of others, depend on others, and keep making it simpler. And I love, even like, in a way, as I kind of recite these seven practices, for me, they feel almost like a poem. There's something very poetic about, you know, love the work, do the work, and ending with keep making it simpler is a, you know, and connect to your pain and connect to the pain of others. That's a little surprising for leadership in the business world. And at the same time, I think as you kind of start to unpack them and look at them, they become more and more practical. They become more like things that you can actually practice, things you can actually do. And I like, you know, I have a bias in a way for this languaging and framing around practices. You know, yes, of course, seven practices. You already alluded to it. You already alluded to, oh, seven habits, and I often get asked, well, what's the difference between a practice and a habit? And for me, a practice has a bit more intentionality in it. A habit is almost meant to become without intention, or meant to be something that is almost like unconscious. Practices, in a way, are meant to be conscious, and you kind of need again and again to remind yourself. And interestingly enough, the word mindfulness, the Sanskrit word sati, that we translate into mindfulness, it literally means to remember. So mindfulness practice, in a way, it's remembering to be present, remembering that you're alive, remembering to wake up and see with as much clarity as you possibly can, and part of that is that it's just so easy to be lulled into our state of assumptions and habit, and maybe not so wholesome habits. So, you know, I like, I'm quite fond of these seven practices.
The word mindfulness is, I don't remember hearing that word in sort of popular culture even 10 years ago, but now you see it everywhere. Do you have any idea how that word sort of became the word to refer that generally people, when they think of meditation now, are thinking of mindfulness?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, we have to go back to a man named Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was a professor, researcher at University of Massachusetts. And this goes back, you know, 30, 40 years ago. You know, he was someone who came from the Buddhist world and from the world of meditation, but he was training people in mindfulness as a way of treating pain. That there were doctors and different people in the medical profession who kept bumping into patients who they, using conventional methods, were not being successful in treating people's pain issues. And they sent them to John's, had a clinic there, and he was finding great success through breathing strategies, and by paying a different kind of attention, this kind of mindful attention to pain, was having success at that. And then he started writing some books about it that became more and more popular. And then he started a program called mindfulness-based stress reduction that became more and more popular, especially in the medical field, working with people to treat pain. I think that was, and I think that had a something to do with it. And then I think also, you know, the program that I helped start within Google, that goes back. Oh, that program was now, you know, about 13 years ago. And this was a program, a mindfulness program called Search Inside Yourself. And the fact that it had the credibility and backing of Google, And we are now bringing mindfulness into the work world all around the world, even outside of Google. And then there just seemed to be a general, the media started giving a lot more attention to this word mindfulness. It was on the front page of Time magazine. And again, how interesting that we're having this conversation when today's New York Times, as I said, how the military is adapting mindfulness.
And of course, anything that happens at Google is going to get paid, the world's going to pay some attention. So that leads me to the question of how did you get into Google?
great question. Well, I, after I got my MBA degree, I ended up starting and running a publishing company. Interesting. It's funny. I've been thinking a lot about, I started a company that was called Brush Dance, like paintbrush, Brush Dance. And we were one of the first companies in the world to make things out of recycled paper. We were making greeting cards and calendars and journals, but we were also, licensing the words of the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh and poetry of Rumi. And I ran that company for 15 years. And at the end of that time, I left that company. I sold my interest in it and I started a coaching practice. And right away, somehow, I was introduced to a Google engineer who hired me to be his coach, which led me to working with other Google engineers as a coach. And it was right at that time that a Google engineer had this idea of creating a mindfulness program inside of Google. And he heard about me. He was looking for a few people that had long-term meditation practices, and he also wanted someone who had some background in the world of business and work, and I had just been CEO of a fairly substantial publishing company, and I always continued my meditation mindfulness practice, and that's how I got a call. Am I interested in helping to develop a program inside of Google? And then interestingly enough, it was like, oh, and by the way, there's no budget. Would you be willing to volunteer your time to do this? And I said, sure. It seems a little strange. Google wants me to be a volunteer, but whatever. And little by little, as I said, the program became more and more popular, and I ended up spending more and more time at Google. And
I hope eventually got paid.
We did eventually. Eventually, Google nicely supported the program. And then eventually, I created a nonprofit organization in partnership with this Google engineer in order to take this work that we had developed inside of Google and to take it around into other organizations. And I was I was back in the CEO seat. I was the CEO of that organization for about 5 years.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we're speaking today with Mark Lesser, author of Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. And Mark, would you like to read a little bit for our audience?
Sure. Yes, love to. Thank you for the invitation. So I'm going to read just a few paragraphs from the epilogue of Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader. My experience teaching mindfulness at Google and to companies and individuals around the world is that there is a tremendous need and hunger for understanding and developing greater humanness, openness, and inspiration, not only at work, but in all parts of our lives. Mindfulness practice is potent. It enables us to see more clearly and to engage with the miracle of consciousness, the miracle of being alive. mindfulness practice can shift the ground of our consciousness, our presence, our being. Not by adding something, such as a new belief system, or by seeking inspiration, but by presenting a more accurate view of what is, of human nature, and how we construct and constrict our version of ourselves and the world. Mindfulness practice is aimed at understanding and shifting the nature of fear, dissatisfaction, and the experience of separateness. Mindfulness practice helps us glimpse how what we thought was ordinary is extraordinary, how mundane life is miraculous at the same time. Why is mindful leadership and being a human being so difficult? Why does it take so much attention and effort to be present, to wake up to our lives, to discover again and again that we're not here long, and to pay attention to what is in our heart, to what is right here, to what is most obvious and most important right now? Reflecting on this, I can't help but think about my friends, the three apes who play a central metaphoric role in this book. They represent the evolution of our bodies, minds, and hearts, and our primary needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection. Human beings did not evolve, were not designed to see clearly, but primarily to survive, to pass on our genes. Being a mindful leader requires effort because it requires letting go of old constructed realities, the norms that no longer serve us, our organizations or our families. Living with clarity and depth, living a mindful, integrated, warm-hearted life takes practice. Aspiring to be a mindful leader and engaging in these seven practices helps calm the nervous ape's vigilance and fear, its proclivity to scan for threats. It satisfies the imaginative ape who is always seeking something new and better, and it reassures the empathic ape that we are always connected beyond anything we can comprehend. Engaging in mindfulness practice calls forth our basic sanity in the midst of a world that often feels chaotic. Mindfulness practice knocks on the door of our inborn openness and trust in a world that can often feel cold and cynical. Considering why mindful leadership is so difficult and necessary, I also return to the themes of pain and possibility. This is the pain of change, of not getting what we want and of getting what we don't want. Opening to possibility shifts our relationship with desire itself, rather than striving to satisfy our desires, though that might happen. Our freedom lies in radical acceptance of what is, as well as in the power of awareness. Seeing inner freedom as possible is a core underlying aspect of mindfulness and mindful leadership. Everyone wants to leave the endless changes. This is a line from a 6th century verse by Dongshan, the founder of the Soto Zen school in China. Time and change are beyond our usual rational understanding. You are not alone in your resistance to change. Staying with the questions, staying with what is, takes courage. Notice what happens when you fully enter your life, your experience, with less resistance. And when resistance arises, great, notice your resistance. It's a terrific teacher. Later in the same verse, Dongshan says, when we stop bending and fitting our lives, we come back to sit by the fire. What would it be like to pause, to stop bending and fitting your life, to not hold back, then to sit relaxed and alert by the warmth of our innermost knowing, feeling the heat from the fire within and around us that always burns? And that's the end of the epilogue.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Mark. I wanted to talk for a minute about the first practice, which is love the work. We often hear young people given the advice, do what you love, and the money will follow. You've probably heard that one before. And
sure.
I, as an entrepreneur, I have a number of several companies that I've founded or co-founded, and I like to turn that on its head a little bit, which I think maybe might be more aligned with what you're saying, which is love what you do. Whatever shows up that day, do it, give it your best, and then you will be successful.
Yeah, and even I'm yes, and I want to just kind of add to that, which is what I mean by love the work is that the primary work that we all have is to become more aware, to become more aware of our both our biases and proclivities and places where we are conditioned or closed, and to become more aware of our resources and intuitions. So it's the practice of studying our own humanness, our own humanity, that, and the work of how we can support and help other people. To me, this is the work, and to me the things that how that translates into whatever businesses we might be starting or working for, you know, again, whether we're a teacher or a doctor or a business person or whatever, the real work is the work of discovering our real full functioning humanity. And this was, so to me, that's the work. And then it's interesting to me that then the second practice is do the work, is that, well, how do you actually do that? Now, having said that, of course, you know, the particular function that we have, the people we're working with, the kind of work we're doing, I'm not at all saying that doesn't matter. Of course it matters. But it's, to me, it's almost secondary to what I think the real work is. And that to me is the turning that, you know, these ideas of loving the work on its head.
Very interesting.
I have read that there's a nerve, there's something physiological. There's a nerve that runs down through your thorax, and that's part of the belly breathing. And when you activate that, it calms the organs in your body. Is that true?
Yeah, this sounds like, I think what you're referring to is the vagus nerve.
Yes.
Which,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of research. In fact, it's interesting even. You know, in some way, people might feel a little queasy or concerned about hearing that the military is using these techniques. But in part, they're using these techniques so that people are not traumatized. You know, people who are young men and women who are put in incredibly traumatic, right, dreadful situations, have some of greater kind of inner skills, including getting in touch with your breath and your body. And mm-hmm. there's more and more evidence that having that training provides them with some greater ability to deal with the dreadful, chaotic situations while in it. And then when they return to, to civilian life, that they are kind of less prone to all of the difficulties from, you know, post-traumatic stress. There's a lot of work being done now, work being done with like firefighters and emergency people here and police, people who put themselves in difficult, chaotic situations, having these tools can help. Now, A lot of people at work are in, you know, work itself can be quite demanding and difficult and chaotic. Maybe, of course not at the same level as what the kinds of, you know, whether it's war or emergencies, but I think we all need these to have these practices that can help us build that kind of inner strength.
So, Mark.
Oh, I agree.
Mark, in the your third practice is don't be an expert. Let go of thinking you are right and be vulnerable. Is that a tough one for people in a position of leadership to accept?
Yeah, it's a tough one for all of us, don't you think?
Yeah.
Right.
Probably.
You know, we all want to be right. We all want to be experts. Who doesn't? And you know, so you know, and there's something very potent and powerful about becoming, you know, more expert in whatever your particular craft is. But when it comes to relationships and when it comes to humanness, that's where none of us are experts, right? That would, no matter how much we develop ourselves, there's always more to learn. And part of not being an expert is to really notice that we can never know what another person's experience is. And to be curious, to be more and more curious about what's motivating other people, what's important to other people. So it's an interesting and challenging path for a leader to walk, right? Sometimes leaders, you know, need to be decisive, need to make decisions, need to say we're going in this direction. That's part of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, these are a little paradoxical, but it's, I think, an important paradox of being able to cultivate both a sense of confidence in oneself and be able to make the tough decisions, and at the same time to realize that to ask the good questions and not to hold too tight to anything.
Mm. I think, too, we have to remember that there are no two people that are exactly alike, physiologically or psychologically. I mean, just as an example of that, no two people react the same way to medicines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One person, it cures, another person, it doesn't, or helps, another person, it doesn't. And that's because we're all different. We're all individuals. And I think we tend to forget that sometimes.
And you can learn from everyone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, Mark, we only have a few minutes left. Let's talk a little bit more about your writing process. You mentioned that you like to write in short bursts. Do you write on computer? Do you write on paper? Or both?
I write on computer. Ever since I almost failed handwriting in second grade, my writing has always been. I can barely read my own writing. I write on a computer.
And when you're working on a book, is it kind of a full-time occupation, or are you trying to fit it in among everything else that you would normally be doing?
Almost always fitting it in. And, I sometimes will get up a few hours earlier, and when I'm really in it, I schedule writing times around the edges of my life. And the other thing, one of my big writing secrets is that I usually get an editor involved very early in the process. I actually engage someone, and I make promises about when I'm going to have certain pieces of writing to them. So like right now, yeah. I'm actually in the process of putting another book proposal together. And I called my editor the other day and said, I'm going to have you, and I'm going to pay for your time in about 3 weeks from now. I'm going to have you the first draft of the introduction and table of contents to my next book. And I have to have those kinds of not only deadlines, but
commitments.
Commitments. I have to, yeah. And not that I always make them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, it's like But, you know, and it wouldn't be that unusual where I'd call them and say, I'm sorry, but it's not happening, but I will, you know, I need a little more time. But once I do that, there it's a combination, I think, of voicing it out loud. I'm going to do, this is something I'm going to do that I've said and I've said to another person. It reminds me, again, I hadn't thought of this. It's like how I, the story I told about how I started my meditation practice. That there is,
of course.
There is something about being, at least for me, maybe this isn't for everyone, but for me, it's that this process is, it's like being in relationship and being in a conversation and holding up my end of it.
And so you're getting feedback from the editor all along the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And now I've now, one of the things that I've learned is that I find it helpful even very early on to work with someone on what I think of as the conceptual or developmental part of the book. I used to wait until, you know, the book was kind of well along and then start to get feedback. I find it really helpful to get that, to have, and often I'm working maybe formally with an editor, but then I'm also working informally, you know, with a few friends and getting feedback and kind of testing out ideas.
Well, I think that's part of what you say about how connected we are. You recognize those connections, and sometimes people think writing is a totally solitary activity, but mm-hmm. if you want, you know, most people are writing because they want someone to read it. And it's probably
right.
good to get feedback from readers along the way.
Yeah. And again, I have to say, I usually feel like I haven't done that nearly enough. I'm mostly working with, you know, very closely with one or two people. But again, that's so different. It's not like I'm not doing it in, you know, by myself. I'm doing
right.
it with. I feel like I have this partner. And there's a lot. There's usually a lot of back and forth, and it's really helpful. You know, I'll send something, and it'll come back very gently. You know, like I don't understand any of this. You know, I think you should.
I'm not sure that's so gentle.
Well, it's usually I think you should save this story. Maybe this will fit in the next book, but I don't think it's fitting here in this, or I'm not really understanding it. And that's really helpful because I always feel like I'm way too close to my writing, and I just that outside perspective. And then it's so beautiful, you know, when it's like, love this story. This is, or unpack this story more. This story has a lot. There's a lot here. And that's just so meaningful, that kind of encouragement.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Writers' Voices today.
It's been a real pleasure being with both of you. Thank you.
And, Mom, do you have some parting words?
Well, this is actually from his book on page 143. It's from a quote from Einstein. May all leaders in the world be wise and compassionate, thus creating the conditions for world peace.
That's a great quote. Well, thank you all, and see you next week.